name is Katrin Becker. I'm from Texas A&M University. So, and I will be teaching the this course this week. Now, so our time is very limited, so I would like, without more introductions, I would like to get straight to the point. So I will be discussing strings with Wojcik supersymmetry, strings with space-time supersymmetry, heterotic strings, and T-duality and D-brains. So this is a tall order, so this is, are many chapters in the book. So I hope to give you an overview of the subject. I will be skipping a few things that you may discuss in more detail in the tutorials. And even if I skip those things, I hope it's still going to be a coherent story. Now, let's start with a brief review of the bosonic string, just to make sure that we are on the same page. So the starting point for perturbative. Now, so the starting point for any discussion of perturbative string theory are one-dimensional objects propagating through space and time. So let me stick for the moment to three dimensions. That's easier to visualize. So imagine we are in three dimensions, and we would like to describe the motion of a point particle between points A and B through some trajectory that is parameterized by a parameter. Let's call it tau. Then we know that the point particle is going to propagate in such a way that the length of the walk line is going to be the minimal. It's going to have the smallest value. So this means that an action to describe this motion, a good action, is minus the mass times the length of the walk line. Now, for strings, for perturbative strings, the story is somehow similar. Instead of having a point-like object propagating like this, we are going to have a two-dimensional object, something like this, that is going to propagate in some way. Now, so since this object is two-dimensional, now we need not only one parameter, but we need two. So we are going to call those sigma over here and maybe tau. In this case, so we have two Wojcik coordinates, sigma and tau. And in this case, an action is going to be a constant that is going to be the string tangent times d mu 2, where mu 2 is the area of the Wojcik. Area of the Wojcik. And again, classically, the string is going to propagate in such a way that this area is minimal. So it's sort of the same story as for point particles. Now, so classically, an action that is equivalent to this one over here is the so-called sigma model action. Let's call this a sigma model action. Actually, I should have left my beautiful picture here. Let me draw it again. So we have our worksheet that propagates like this, right? So we have the sigma model action. And over here, x mu are the vectors that describe the embedding of this worksheet into space-time, x mu, which is going to be a function of sigma and tau. So describes x mu, describes the embedding of string in space-time. So G over here is the space-time metric that I'm going to take to be flat for this discussion. So that's the space-time metric. Again, we are going to consider the case in which strings propagate in flat space-time. Now, the novelty in this action is this auxiliary field H of C. Field. And as you probably have heard last week, if you eliminate H using its equation of motion, then the sigma model action becomes equivalent to this one, to the so-called Nambu-Goto action. All right, now, so this is sort of the starting point for our discussion of the perturbative bosonic string. Now, this action has got symmetries. So there are global symmetries. Which are Poincaré transformations in space-time. So A mu nu Lorentz, that can be Lorentz transformations or translations. So A and B are constant. So and delta H, so H is constant, delta H is equal to zero. So A and B are constant. Now there are also local symmetries. Now, so local symmetries, there are two of them. There are diffeomorphisms. So if I change the way the undercoordinate transformations on the word sheet, so let's say we send, so sometimes I'm going to talk about sigma and tau, so other times I'm going to talk about sigma 1 and sigma 0, so these are the same thing. So sigma is going to be sigma 1 and tau is going to be sigma 0. Now, so under diffeomorphisms, sigma alpha, so we do coordinate transformations on the word sheet to some new coordinates that are called f. So x mu behave like scalars, x mu of f, and h alpha beta transforms like a tensor on the word sheet. I'm running out of Blackboard. Maybe I'll just continue over there. And then another type of local symmetry are the Weyl scalings. Now, well, I had to erase the reaction, but anyway. So Weyl scalings. Since this is a review, hopefully this should be okay. So the action that I just erased is invariant under Weyl scalings, under which H transforms like this. And the fields X are constant. So delta X is equal to zero. Now, so the local symmetries are important because they allow us, because then we have three local parameters. So alpha takes values 0 and 1. So we have two functions that we can choose, f0 and f1. And another free function is phi. So we have three, let's say, free functions. And we can choose for these our favorite value. So the free functions are f0, f1, and phi. Now, so, and we are going to use these free functions to choose a certain gauge, the so-called conformal gauge, where h is equal to, so that's equal to h0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. Okay. So we have, since it's symmetric, we have three unknown functions here, and we have, if we simply count, we have three functions that we can choose. Well, and all of these act on the metric, And we are going to choose these functions in such a way that this is simply a flat metric. So this is equal to eta alpha beta. So this is the so-called conformal gauge. Now, however, even after choosing this conformal gauge for H, we still have a residual symmetry in which diffeomorphisms are canceled against wild transformations. So still, there is residual symmetry in which diffeomorphisms are canceled against by transformations. And one can show, so hopefully you have discussed this last week, that these are actually conformal transformations. Now, these residual symmetries are important because they allow us to choose the electron gauge. So, the residual symmetries allow us to choose the electron gauge. Right, in which we set x plus of sigma tau, so in which we can choose Wolschi tau parameter that is identified with x plus. One can use the one chooses the x plus in this way. And moreover, it turns out that the sigma model action depends on H alpha beta, but not its derivatives. So this means that the variation, which happens to be proportional to the energy momentum tensor, the variation of the action with respect to H is equal to zero, and one can use this constraint to eliminate all the, let's say, alpha minus oscillators, alpha minus n oscillators. So what this Lyapunov gauge basically says is usually, well, we have a field, right, that satisfies some wave equation, and then we have some zero mod, and we have some oscillators. And the Lyapunov gauge, all the oscillators corresponding to when mu is equal to this plus coordinate are equal to zero. And one can show, hopefully you discussed this last week, that the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor can be used to solve for these oscillators in terms of the transverse ones. So this was sort of this should be enough to construct the spectrum of the bosonic string of the Lyapunov gauge. So there's going to be a ground state zero that is so the modes of the fields x, they are going to be creation and annihilation operators, and there's going to be a state that is annihilated by all the annihilation operators, and the creation operators acting on this vacuum, for example, like a state like this, so I is equal to 1 to 24. So these are going to be states in the spectrum. So one acts only with transverse modes. So the critical dimension of the bosonic string is 26. But once x plus once the plus and minus coordinates are taken out, so we only act with oscillators like, for example, this ones or several oscillators like this. Now, so only with the transverse modes. So there are different types of string, the open and the closed string. Let's talk, for example, a bit more in detail about the closed string. It turns out that the mass formula for the closed string looks like this, n minus 1, n tilde minus 1, where n is the number operator counting the number of alpha of creation operators acting on the vacuum. And so we have left movers and right movers. Now, so these are integers, n and tilde. And so the first state in the spectrum is like this. So n and n tilde would be equal to 0. So they have to be equal. In that case, alpha prime m squared is equal to minus 4. N can be equal to, let's say, at the next level, if we talk about the closed string, n is equal to n tilde is equal to 1. In this case, we would have states like this, alpha minus 1 I, alpha minus 1 j, acting on the vacuum. Let's call this omega ij. So this would be if n and n tilde is equal to 1. This is a mass, these are massless states. So in this case, m squared is equal to 0. Now, the ground state, obviously, if m squared is equal to minus 4, well, that's the Taffian, right? So it's not good because m squared is negative. At the massless level, we have all the states alpha ij. Now, again, I and j now run over 24 values. So I is equal to 1 to 24. Same for j, ij is equal to 1 to 24. And so here we're taking the tensor product of two fundamental representations of SO24. This can be, so we can write this in terms of Young tableaus if we want. So we get the state that doesn't transform, a state that is symmetric and traceless, and an antisymmetric state. So this over here would be the dilaton. This would be symmetric and traceless, the graviton. And this over here would be the antisymmetric tensor. Now, we can write this in terms of Young tableaus, or we can also write it in plain English by simply saying that, so if we call this omega ij, right, so then we can group those states in the following way. So as 1 divided by 24 delta ij trace of omega. So what I'm doing is I'm taking this state and I'm reshuffling the things in objects that transform in an irreducible way under SO24. Omega ij plus omega ji minus delta ij divided by 24 trace of omega plus 1 half omega ij minus omega ji. So this is just an identity. So this is equal to omega ij, right? So this over here is an object that does not transform under SO24. So it's the dilaton. So I added it here. I did subtract it here. The same thing over here. So here I added the thing and I did subtract it here. So it's done in such a way that the state is symmetric. So this would be gij in this notation, symmetric and traceless, and this would be bij. Good. So this is what this notation here with this Young tableau is saying. All right, now, questions? So this should hopefully be clear because all of this was discussed last week. But please, again, feel free to interrupt me if there's anything I should repeat or explain in more detail. Now, worrisome about the spectrum are several things. First of all, so what's worrisome about the spectrum? Yes, exactly. So that's cries out for this is disaster, right? So there's a Taffian over here. A Taffian is bad, right? Because it's like saying, so what does it mean to have a Taffian? Well, a Taffian is like saying, well, imagine you have a scalar field theory and you want to expand about a ground state. And if you expand about a ground state with m squared negative, it's like saying you're doing an expansion about this point, right? So this would be a point with m squared negative. Well, you don't want to expand about that point. Everything runs away. So that's an unstable critical point. So you don't want to do that. This means that one is expanding about the wrong vacuum. Now, the other bad thing is the absence of fermions. And talking about string theory, one hears impressive things like, for example, well, quantum field theory is not compatible with gravity, right? So if you try simply you take gravity theory and you just try to quantize it, like quantum field theory, doesn't really work. The theory is non-renormalizable, etc. So everything goes wrong. So quantum field theory, it seems to be predicting that gravity doesn't work. But string theory, on the other hand, seems to be predicting that gravity exists, right? So we quantize the bosonic string and we find a graviton in the spectrum. So string theory requires gravity, for example. But this is good, but the problem is there's more than gravity in nature. There's also fermions, right? So, and in the spectrum of the bosonic string, there are only bosons. There is scalar particle, another scalar. Here we have a metric, anti-symmetric tensor. So these are all bosonic particles. So to describe nature, we need fermions. So the fermions are the building blocks of matter. Now, so to remedy this in string theory, we introduce supersymmetry. So introduce supersymmetry. Okay. So that's what we are going to talk about. All right. Now there are so strings and supersymmetry. Okay, there are two ways of incorporating supersymmetry in perturbative string theory. One is called the RNS formalism, Ramon Neville-Schwarz formalism, or also called strings with Wachit supersymmetry. So in this case, we are going to have a string action. We are going to keep the coordinates describing the bedding of the string in space-time. So these are going to be space-time vectors. Right? So there's this index mu, and this object that are going to transform as vectors of the Lorentz group in whatever dimensions we are, in d dimensions. So these are space-time vectors. But from the worksheet point of view, this just appears as a bunch of scalars, right? So we write down the action, and this is somehow just like an index labeling all the all different scalars. So space-time vectors and worksheet scalars. Worksheet scalars. Now, so the most naive thing to do is simply to say, well, we look at the theory on the worksheet, and for every scalar corresponding to one value of mu, we are going to add a fermion like this. So if mu is 1, we add 1 fermion to this, or this is going to be 1 spinor. So we read this as a word, as a two-dimensional, as a scalar in two dimensions, and then we take this to be a spinor in two dimensions. So this is going to be a two-dimensional spinor, but it still carries this mu index. So it's going to be so it's a two-dimensional spinor, but a space-time vector. So carries, let's say, the mu index. So it's the same index as the one on X. Now, so here we are going to work with, again, with two-dimensional spinors. And then we are going to construct the action, and we are going to quantize the theory, construct the spectrum, and et cetera. Now, the advantage of this approach is simplicity. So we are going to see that without much work, we can immediately write down a pretty, in a pretty easy way an action, right? Because we know if we go to conformal gauge, this is just a bunch of free scalars. Well, what are we going to do? We are going to add a bunch of free fermions. There's nothing easier than that, right? Sort of in first approximation. So the advantage of this approach is simplicity. The big disadvantage is that what we are really interested in is supersymmetry in space-time, right? So we want to see, in the spectrum of the string, we would like to see space-time spinors. But that's not obvious because this object is a space-time vector. So we will have to work pretty hard to see space-time supersymmetry in this approach. Space-time supersymmetry is not obvious. Okay. Then there's another approach that is called the GS formalism, which are strings with space-time supersymmetry, which we are also going to discuss. So this is GS formalism. This is green and Schwarz formalism. Also sometimes called strings with space-time supersymmetry. So in which we are going to keep, again, we did, of course, the fields describing the embedding of the string in space-time. But then the fields that are added to this, the fermionic fields, are like this. Let me call them theta. And they carry an index A that is a space-time spinor index. And we are also going to allow a second index that is going to be capital A in case that we want more than one supersymmetry. So that can be 1 to n if we want, if there is to be more than one supersymmetry. Now, the advantage of this formalism should be clear. From the very beginning, we talk about space-time spinors. So space-time supersymmetry is going to be manifest from the very beginning here. But it's going to be a pain to write an action in this formalism. I mean, just to come up with a good guess, everything is going to be nonlinear and complicated. And so this one is much more work. But again, so in this approach, space-time supersymmetry is manifest. But not simple. Let me call it. So while here we can in an easy way write down an action, in the GS formalism we will have to work much harder. Questions? Sorry.
Does everybody know what supersymmetry actually is? What's the relevance of supersymmetry?
Well, we are going to discuss some supersymmetry. I'm going to discuss some aspects of supersymmetry in this lecture. I mean, we will, okay. So over here, we are going to discuss a little bit of supersymmetry. We are going to define what it is. So it will be sort of part of the lectures, let's say this way. It will be discussed more in detail in the tutorials to show, for example, that the supersymmetry is present in the action that I'm going to write down. But some of the basics I'm going to explain. All right, more questions that are not from the tutor. We may not know about supersymmetry, but
in certain bosonic string theory, those X's are just scalar fields on the world sheet.
Yes.
On that flat strip in the comic space.
Right.
That you're having the world sheet.
Yeah.
So are the sides also just scalar fields?
No, whoa. So that's going to be we are going to look at this from a two-dimensional perspective. So we are going to look at the kind of theory in two dimensions, right? And this over here are going to be a bunch of scalar fields, and this are going to be a bunch of fermions, a bunch of spinors. Right? So objects that satisfy the Dirac equation, if you want, in two dimensions. Except that we have an index mu that labels them, right? So in the same way as we say, so let's set, for example, mu is equal to 1. Then we have one scalar field on the world sheet. We don't care about the interpretation of this index. Then we also set mu is equal to 1, and we talk about a spinor in two dimensions. So it's an object satisfying the Dirac equation in two dimensions, right? And we are going to write on an action like that. And the only point is that we have this index mu that has the interpretation of some space-time vector index that we are going to attach to this. But the way to read this is simply to say, pick your favorite value for mu, and treat this as a scalar, and treat this as a two-component object. Right? Yes, it has a spinor index in two dimensions, exactly. Yes?
I thought that the Dirac equation could only be, that only worked for dimension of 4 or greater.
We are going to have three fermions in two dimensions, right? So we are going to have a boson and we are going to have a free fermion. Okay? Yeah.
It strikes me, why would you want to bother with RNS formalism at all? Because surely we don't care what the world sheet looks like. What we want is supersymmetry in the space. So kind of.
Yes, and no. We could, for example, try to construct directly only GS formalism. But again, it's going to be actually the two formalisms are going to be related, so there are different approaches to one and the same thing. It's more complicated to write this down. This one is so simple that it would be somehow a pity if one wouldn't really try to discuss this. Besides, if we, for example, talk about the theoretic string, we are going to try something like this, and then we are going to. So the first discussion of RNS formalism will be for type 2 strings and type 1. But then we are going to see if we just change the players of the game a little bit. So instead of talking about these two fellows, we add a few additional fields. Then we can describe the heterotic string, and we can, for example, describe non-abelian gate symmetries and so on. So this one has advantages, and in that formalism it would be much more difficult. Yes?
Are we restricting ourselves to spin hats?
What?
Spin hat versus general spin
hat. Here we are, the smallest representations of the Lorentz of, yeah, smallest one. OK, so let's start with RNS formalism, strings with in. All right. So the starting point is the bosonic string in conformal gauge. So as now, one thing I should warn you about. So I'm not going to be careful about constants, about signs, and about factors of I. So I'm going to use some units where plus 1 is equal to minus 1, I is equal to 1, etc. <cetera. laughs> So it's going to keep my formula simpler. There may be sometimes stuff will have funny properties if I complex conjugate, but whatever. So I just want to keep things simple. OK, so we start with a bosonic string in conformal gauge, right? So we have some flat Wachit matrix. So H is equal to eta. Now, since I've chosen already the conformal gauge, I also have to supplement this with the Virasoro constraints. So T alpha beta, the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor. Remember that before choosing the conformal gauge, there is this function H, the auxiliary field. And the action depends on H, but not its derivatives, right? So ds, this is proportional with respect to d alpha beta. So that should be equal to 0. So the vanishing, so the Virasoro constraints. So that is something that I have to add. So I have the action of the bosonic string, and I have the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor. So then what we are going to do is to add to this. So these are three two-dimensional fields. So if you want, we can also say D plus. D alpha, D 2 sigma, D plus x, minus x. All right, now, so what we're going to do is to add to this some two-dimensional fermions. So fields transforming as spinners, like this, C bar mu, and we are going to give them the same level as the fields. So there's an index mu, but again, so we just read this as counting the number of fields, rho alpha, d alpha, psi mu. So this is a kinetic term for a fermion in two dimensions. So rho are going to be two-dimensional Dirac matrices. So objects satisfying the Dirac algebra, like this. So we have a flat Wachit matrix, so that's equal to eta. Say, for example, rho 0 is going to be 0, minus 1, 1, 0. Rho 1 is 1, excuse me, 0, 1, 1, 0. OK. That's the Dirac conjugate. So psi bar times rho 0. Now I'm going to work with real spinners. So this is C mu transpose times the charge conjugation matrix. Now, so we are in two dimensions. So these spinners are going to have two components. Yeah. There's an I somewhere. I is equal to 1. Okay, so we are going to, again, so we are going to have a bunch of spinners over here labeled by an index mu, so psi mu, and it's going to have two components that I'm going to label with psi minus and psi plus. Okay, now we, so this, this Dirac matrices satisfy this Dirac algebra. Then it's a matter of simply taking this object for 0 and for 1. I plug it in here. I write psi as this two-component object, and I simply multiply stuff out. So I'll be careful to take rho into account. And here's, here's the claim. So the action for the fermions, let's call this, okay, I don't have to write it, I suppose. Sf is equal to d2 sigma again up to factors of whatever. D plus psi minus D plus psi minus plus psi plus D minus psi plus. Where, again, so sigma plus minus all the time is sigma plus minus tau. Now, so this is now an object that, so that's hopefully the same psi. Okay, and I should, so I'm skipping, okay. So each of these has an index mu. So that's the same object. And that is now the field. So this has, so psi has these two components, psi plus and psi minus. And here I just have multiplied all this, all the things out. Yeah, well, it should of course be, okay. Actually, let me write it as a dot product. And so just imagine a dot product in there. F of fermion.
Oh.
Yeah, so I was just writing down that. All right. Question? No? All right. So working out the question of motion is pretty easy. We consider variations of fields. So let me write the equations of motion in a suggestive way. So variation with respect to this is d plus c minus mu is equal to 0. And let me write it in this way. D plus D minus X mu. So that's the boson, the equation of motion for the boson, so that object is equal to 0. And D minus C plus X mu. All right. So until now, we have discussed a bunch of bosons and a bunch of fermions, but they were not related in any way. Now, but we, of course, have added them in a certain form. We have given them an index mu. Now, so but if you write an equation of motion, this is already suggesting that there is a relation between the bosons and the fermions because they satisfy the same equation of motion, right? So this object here satisfies the same equation of motion as this object there. So d plus annihilates the thing in the same way over here. So d minus annihilates this and d minus annihilates that. Okay, it turns out that the action we have written down has a very nice property, namely it's invariant under supersymmetric transformations. So the action is invariant under supersymmetric transformations. Well, supersymmetric transformations, I'm going to write them down as a certain way of shifting the field, so transformations that look like this. Now, delta psi mu is equal to rho alpha d alpha x mu epsilon. So some explanation. So at this moment, I'm simply going to say, well, this is a certain type of transformation which leaves the action invariant, and that's a computation that one can do. Now, epsilon over here, so that is an infinitesimal Riesman parameter. Now, the way to think, and it's constant. So it's constant. Okay. So the way to think about this is epsilon is, so upstairs is the minus component, downstairs is plus an object that has got two components. Now, so infinitesimal Grassmann parameter sounds strange. So Grassmann means it's anti-commuting. Infinitesimal, one can think about it as having some kind of small real number in front. I'm not going to write out that real number. So this is what it means for a Grassmann parameter to be infinitesimal. So just imagine like something that is anti-commuting and it has a small real number in front. Okay. Now, so and I claim it's a certain exercise to take these transformations and show that the action is invariant. We can also write it in components like this. So this means that we use the definition of epsilon bar, we write psi in components, and multiply everything out. And here's the claim, this is what we get. And again, the claim is that the action is invariant under those transformations. So if you take x to x plus delta x and psi plus delta psi, the action is invariant. Now, so at this moment, I would like to ask you to take this simply as given. So don't ask why do these transformations look this way. But simply take the action and check that it is invariant under those transformations. Now, we are going to find a much more beautiful description of supersymmetric transformations when we discuss strictly space and supersymmetry, when we will talk about supersymmetry as a translation in a space that has some bosonic coordinates, some bosonic dimensions, and some fermionic dimensions. So there we are going to find or we are going sort of to derive transformations like this. We are going to understand why these transformations look this way. Okay, so what do we have here? So we have an action. We have discussed equations of motion for the bosons, for the fields x, equations of motion for the fields psi. And we saw that there is a certain symmetry under which the fields transform like this. Now, there are two additional equations of motion that we need. Now, to be a little bit sketchy, namely, so two additional equations of motion that we need. Namely, so remember that before fixing the conformal gauge, if we talk about bosonic strings, we had this field H. H alpha beta like that. And one of the equations of motion was the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor, where we consider the variation of the square root with respect to h and of this. right? Since there's no derivative acting on H, so T has to be equal to 0. Now, it turns out that if we add to this fermions, then there's going to be additional contributions coming to the energy momentum tensor coming from the fermions. And they look like this. T plus plus, T minus minus. The other ones are reports. Now, I've not presented the action. Okay, now. Contribution. So this one actually. This contribution from the fermions we could actually still see from the action that I brought down. Probably not. Okay, so I'm going to claim that this over here is the contribution from the fermions. Now, the story where I really have to be sketchy, and I will ask you to, if you want to know more details, we'll ask you to read in, for example, in GSW. Is that in addition to the energy momentum tensor, there is another object that is conserved. Namely, there is supersymmetry is a global symmetry, and associated to it, there's a conserved current. So supersymmetry is a conserved. Supersymmetry is a global symmetry and associated to it is conserved current. It's a conserved current. Now, that we can obtain if we want using the Noether procedure and so on. So that's a long story. So it's easy to see that the object is conserved. So this is the so-called supercurrent. Now, it's easy to see that it's conserved because D minus J plus is equal to 0, right? So just using equations of motion, if I act with D minus on this, I get 0, equation of motion for D plus. If I act with D minus on this, I again get 0, so that's 0. So it's conserved. Now, in the same way as the energy momentum tensor is also conserved. But here's the point, and this is where I really have to be sketchy. There is a stronger condition. Namely, it's not only that the thing is conserved, but that it's actually equal to 0. So it carries a spinner index A, spinner 2D spinner index, and that object is equal to 0. Now, so here's the reason why I'm not going to prove this. I'm going to give you a reference for this. Now, the reason I'm not going to prove this is the following. If we talk about, let's go back to the bosonic string. In order to derive the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor, I need this action with H in there. So before fixing the conformal gauge, right? So before setting H is equal to eta, so I have this action. And then the equation of motion for H is this is equal to 0. Okay. Now, to derive this equation for the supercurrent, what we would have to do is to supersymmetrize this object with H in there. So it's like supersymmetrizing with a metric. So that boils down to constructing a theory with local supersymmetry. And it's it's doable, but not in the given time. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you, so that is something that is explained, for example, in GSW1 in section 4.3.4. So there the construction of worksheet action with local supersymmetry is done. So we need local supersymmetry because we sort of have the, if we talk about a metric, then there's going to be a gravitino associated to it. And this will turn out to be the equation of motion for the gravitino. So that is actually ds, let's say, by d chi a, and that's equal to 0. Now, so if over the weekend you get bored, you want something to do, you take GSW1 and you read section 4.3.4. It's, again, it's doable. It's just a matter of time. And then you will see that there is the constraint of the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor and the vanishing of the supercurrent. Now, so this is important for when we fix the Lightcon gauge, if you remember. So when we fix the Lightcon gauge, we use the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor to eliminate some of the oscillators. And we will need this to eliminate some of the fermionic oscillators. OK, now. So we have talked.
So to construct local supersymmetry, we introduce some gravitino field, and then the variation with respect to that gravitino field, which is
exactly
gives us this.
Exactly. So that would give us. Okay. That is conserved. We already see from what we have on the blackboard. But what we don't see is that the object is actually equal to 0.
Or if there's only kinetic terms of the gravitino field.
Right. So sort of the same story. One would have to construct the action. It's a bit messy, but it's doable. So it's within reach. So again, if you're bored in one weekend, you can probably do it. Okay. So all of this is classical, right? So we have talked about an action with bosons and with fermions. And we've talked about equations of motion. We have talked about equation of motion for x, equation of motion for psi, equation of motion for h, so the vanishing of the energy momentum tensor, but we can also call the Razzurro constraint. And the equation of motion for this gravitino that sets the supercurrent equal to 0. No, but that's still not enough, even in the classical theory, right? So if we have the action and we consider variations of the fields, we want the action to be stationary. Equation of motion is one thing we have to impose. What else? Exactly. So we have to impose boundary conditions. OK, now, so here's the action for the fermions. Again. Right? And so if we derive, we want this action to be stationary. So what we do is to consider variations. So we say psi goes to psi plus delta psi, and we want delta s to be equal to 0. Now, if we take the action and do this variations, then we have to do, in order to derive the equations of motion, we have to do partial integrations, right? So if we, for example, consider the variation of this one, we get d plus acting on delta psi. So we want to do partial derivative, right? So we want to send the derivative to act on this one. Now, in the time coordinate, we usually assume that the ends are fixed, right? So that the variations are equal to zero. So there are no boundary terms there. But there are boundary terms for if we do the sigma derivative. So if we do partial integration in sigma, then we can get boundary terms. But we don't get them if we do a tau partial integration. So this means that delta S, there are two contributions. Let's say the boundaries are located at sigma equal to pi and at sigma equal to 0. Right? So d plus, let's say, is d tau again up to constants. So for the d sigma derivative, d sigma acting on delta psi, we want to do partial integration, and then we get some kind of term like this. So that is the same thing for all the other terms, right? So they are just copycats of each other. So and then we get one contribution at one end of the string, sigma is equal to pi. And one contribution at the other end, sigma is equal to 0, right? Okay, now as for bosonic strings, there are different cases we can consider. There can be open strings, there can be closed strings. So basically for open strings, what we would be doing is canceling these at each end, this against this. For closed strings, we would cancel this one against that one. Okay, now if we say, okay, so we want to consider open strings. We are at one end at sigma is equal to pi. We want to cancel this fellow against that one. Well, it involves two psi's, right? So we cannot fix the sign, right? So it doesn't really matter. So let's say if we consider open strings, we could say C plus of mu is equal to plus minus C minus mu at sigma equal to pi and at sigma equal to 0, right? So the sign drops out because it's quadratic. Now, if we have a fermion, then we can always flip an overall sign. And that doesn't really matter if I call this psi or I call this minus psi. That doesn't really matter. So this means that usually so you can one end, it's a matter of convention, and it's usually done in such a way that one chooses a plus sign at sigma is equal to 0, because the overall sign of a fermion doesn't matter. Now, so this one is a matter of convention that we agree to call this plus. But the sign at the other end then becomes relevant. There are two cases. One is called Ramon boundary conditions. That would be a plus sign at the other end. At sigma equal to pi. So in that case, the fields would have a mod expansion like this, the fermionic fields. So let's say these objects, they, since D plus acting on this is equal to 0, it depends only on sigma minus. And this one would depend only on a sigma plus. And then the boundary condition that at sigma equal to pi, they should be identical, so if sigma is equal to pi. Right, so then so that factor. So then this object are identical. And the coefficients over here, so we get the same oscillators. So same oscillators for right moving, for right movers and for left movers. And then there are Navier-Schwarz boundary conditions, where psi plus of mu is equal to minus, right? That's the other sign, at sigma is equal to pi. So in that case, so each time I talk about Ramon boundary conditions, I will talk about oscillators D having an index n that is an integer. Now, for Navier-Schwarz boundary conditions, the story is a bit different. And the oscillators will be called B. And the indices are going to be called R and S, and these are half integers. Now, half integers, so that the boundary condition with the minus there is satisfied. Sigma tau again, so that's the object psi minus that depends only on sigma minus, because D plus annihilates this. Psi plus is annihilated by D minus, so it depends only on sigma minus tau. And to satisfy the boundary conditions that we have a minus sign here at the other end, we need this R to be half integer. OK, so each time I talk about indices M and N, those are going to be in Z. These are going to be integers. And each time I talk about indices R and S, so these are going to be half integers. All right, so we are still discussing the classical string. We still have not quantized. Oh, just one second. We still have not quantized, so there are still closed boundary conditions. And then, of course, we are going to do canonical quantization, and we are going to construct the spectrum. But this we are going to do in the next class. Yes, yes, these are the same oscillators, because we want these boundary conditions here to be satisfied, right? So they have to be equal. It's different for the closed string, where we would have left movers and right movers, so there is going to be B, let's say, and W tilde.
So because if you know, one is half of two, okay. So do you want to be one? You want to be all?
No, not zero. Let's write it. Plus minus one half. Plus minus three half. That's what I mean. Okay. Again, so then, so these are open strings. Then there are closed strings. We still have to discuss those. I will mention those next time. And then we are going to do exactly the same thing as for the bosonic string. We are going to have a ground state. We are going to do canonical quantization. And we are going to construct the states by acting with creation operators on the ground state. And that's why we are going to construct our spectrum that will then hopefully have some interesting properties. But that we are going to do then in the next class. More questions? No? Well, I guess see you then tomorrow at the same time.